In this episode of the Smart City podcast, I interviewed the practical futurist, Andrew Grill. We discuss a number of interesting topics that fit into the smart city space. We talk about the future of work and how it's not all about the millennials, much to my disgust. We also discuss what digital diversity is and why it is important on our decision-making boards, and also why the new GDPR, or General Data Protection Regulation, should actually empower us to use our data how we want to and to our advantage. I really enjoyed this futuristic yet practical chat. So as always, I hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
It's the Smart City Podcast, whoa, with Smart City experts, here we go. Connecting smart technology, both big and small. Smart cities are making life better for all. Big data, emerging trends, self-driving cars and more. The Smart City Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Andrew. How are you?
Zoe, great to talk to you all the way from London, England.
Ah, that's awesome. Yes, I'm sitting here in Brisbane. It's a beautiful evening, so I hope it's a beautiful morning there in London.
We've already had our spring. That's the one day of the year that's a good day. So we're now into the normal weather.
Yeah, nice. I don't envy you on that part. So let's jump straight into this. And you call yourself the practical futurist. Tell me what that means.
Yeah, I do that deliberately. Now, I'm a big fan of futurists, and I've seen my fair few. My favourite futurist is Arthur C. Clarke, who famously co-authored 2001 Space Odyssey, which is 50 years old this year. And I found a clip actually from an Australian ABC journalist who interviewed Arthur in 1974, and he had his son with him. He said, look, what will life be like for my son in the year 2001? And Arthur gave an absolutely pinpoint accurate description of what the world will be like. We'd have computers in our own homes, we'd be able to work away from our desks. He even talked about the societal impacts of technology on humans. The issue was he was looking at things that were 30 years in the future. And most of the audiences that I present to haven't got 30 years. They haven't got 30 months, haven't got 30 weeks. They need to know right now what they can do tomorrow, next week, next quarter to change what they're doing so they're not being disrupted. So I deliberately brand myself as the practical futurist. And I've tested that. I spoke a few months ago at an event, and on the day someone beautifully tweeted that they were getting some value out of what I was saying. 25 hours later, they tweeted, we've just had our team meeting and I'm putting into play some of the things that Andrew mentioned. So I really want to give people on this podcast, whenever they see me in person on stage, practical tips and tricks that they can go away with rather than being delighted by what might happen in 30 years. We might be in flying cars. We might be on Mars. How do I close the quarter? How do I write my strategy to get me through the next few months? So I think it's done deliberately, but just as you found it, it invites a discussion. What's the difference between a practical futurist and a plain vanilla futurist?
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's backtrack a little bit. And can you tell us a little about your background and what you're passionate about?
Well, if I reverse my career, I ended up here in London. I've been here 12 years. I came over with a startup. In fact, a couple of very smart academics at UTS in Sydney had developed some technology around location-based services. And I was in Sydney at the time, back in 2004, 2005. And for my sins, my first client was a company called Vodafone, who are headquartered here in London. And so I was on a plane every 3 weeks from Sydney to London, so I ended up moving here. But before then, I did an engineering degree, so I have a very practical, technical background. I know which end of the soldering iron is hot, although I haven't used one for a while. Spent some years at British Aerospace. I spent some stints at Telstra and Optus in Australia, big telcos, before 12 years of startups. And then IBM more recently, where I spent 4 years as a global managing partner, traveling the world, again, trying to help clients understand the power of technology and collaboration and helping them not be disrupted. So very practical, technical background. The startup background really helped to understand what it's like to work with a limited budget, work with primitive technology and get that to market. So I would like to think not only because I'm Australian, I'm pragmatic, I've got the scars to prove it.
Yeah, cool. So obviously you're on the Smart City podcast. So I want to know how you kind of fit into the Smart City space.
Yeah, I mean, smart cities have been discussed for a while, and back at IBM, we spent a lot of time talking about the smarter planet and the start of the smarter city, and they're doing a lot of work around that. And I think a lot of the technologies that we're seeing come out of incubator stage now are really helping smart cities meet their goal. Smart city concept's been around for a while, where everything's connected and everyone's talking to each other, and we can see what's going on. And things like Internet of Things, IoT, mean that organizations can now augment and instrument almost anything. If we're talking about logistics or waste management, I know there's a governor, I think it's in New Jersey, who has a dashboard in his office that basically looks at all the instrumentable things that are happening in his city right there and then. And I've used that example with large banks, large telcos, to say whatever you can measure, if you can measure and put it on a screen and see what's happening in real time, you can get a sense of your ecosystem. If that ecosystem is a city and you're managing a city like Sydney or Brisbane, and you can augment and instrument as many things as you can, you can then see real time what's going on. And other technologies like blockchain, they are going to help distribute that technology around and keep the one version of the truth. So where I kind of fit in is, because I'm a futurist, I look at all technologies and all industries, and I keep bumping into the notion of the smart cities, and some cities, some organizations are making a reality and have it in their kind of mission statement, and others are sort of, you know, paying it lip service. But it really requires that senior management, whether it be the leader of the council or the premier or the prime minister, whoever it is that runs that city or country, really having a vision to be able to make things easier. And I think it's not technology for technology's sake. I think technology that makes my life easier and it makes where I live easier to work, live and play, augmented with technology, is something that I aspire to, and aspire to live in places that also help that happen. A simple example here in London, the mayor's office some years ago decided to open up the data feeds from Transport for London that run all the tubes and all the buses. And now, if you're a web developer, you can take a feed of the bus timetable update. I can literally be sitting in my local Starbucks outside a bus stop and not have to get up until a minute before I know the bus is actually due, because they have augmented and measured all the buses and they've got GPS on board. So while London isn't a total smart city, there are things like that that are demonstrably helping consumers lead better lives.
Yeah, definitely. So you've probably answered this a little bit, but in a nutshell, what is a smart city to you?
Well, I think a smart city is a city that you want to, it makes it easier to work, live or play without tech being in the way. You don't see tech right in front of you. You don't see the smart rubbish bins. You don't see the Wi-Fi connectivity. You don't see the GPS on the buses. You just know that it makes your life easier. And I think the perfect smart city isn't a smart city that calls itself a smart city. It just is.
Yeah. No, I really like that. I spent a little bit of time in Seoul, which I know calls itself a smart city, but what they actually call is the smart city is, you know, Songdo, the ones that they built from the ground up. But, I mean, I went to both. And when I was in Seoul, like you just mentioned, I felt like I was in a smart city. I didn't see the tech, but I felt safe. I felt like I could get around easily, even with, you know, the strong language barrier. But that's what I would consider a smart city. Whereas Songdo, when I went there, there's lots of tech around. But there's not a lot of people. So is it really a city if there's not a lot of people?
Yeah, you don't want robots everywhere or autonomous cars. You want it to feel like it's inviting, and that tech just helps you enjoy the city even more.
Yeah, definitely. So my next question is, why do you think that concept is so important to us as a community, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of technology for good, the fact that technology can improve your life, although what Arthur C. Clarke that I mentioned before, he noted that there are societal impacts. And even now, the creators of Google and Apple products are now saying maybe we went too far and we gave too many dopamine hits. But I think the concept is important, because you can then, you know, have that really easy place to live, that the information you need is at your fingertips, and that the decisions that are being made about your city, about how waste is managed, about how lighting is done, it comes from a center of having data. Smart cities have, you know, so much data that's there, and the challenge is, how do you make sense of that? How do you work out where we need to plan new things? I've been following very closely what's been happening with the NBN, the National Broadband Network in Australia, and the fact that you can have streets in Dubbo, for example, where one side is connected to the fibre to the premise, which is very fast, the other side of the road is connected fibre to the node, which is slower. And I hear that real estate agents are getting inquiries about, places to rent or to buy. And they're not just asking, is it close to a school? They're asking, what speed broadband does it have? And that for me brings into play now that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I had, didn't have ADSL. I had, dial up. I was working for Telstra. So I had 128 kilobytes to my home. And I thought that was amazing. Everyone else had 33.6 kilobit dial up. And I had, you know, almost five, six, seven times that amount. So I think a smart city plans ahead and says, rather than plan, you know, for a specific type of technology, we know that people will want to connect. We know that they'll need to move large files, whether it be video, audio, or augmentation of their cars and their homes. How do we just future-proof that and plan that? So I think why the concept is important is that you need to have, and we might maybe talk about this in a moment, the notion of digital diversity, that people that understand digital concepts are up at the top level making those decisions, rather than saying, what's cloud, what's IoT? Those terminologies roll off their tongue, and in planning the things you have to do around the built environment with a city, you actually plan ahead all the things that you don't think you might need right away that you'll need in the future.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk about some of the projects and things that you're currently working on.
Well, I work on a lot of things. So I'm less about doing, more about helping people understand how they get to the point of doing. So I don't do a lot of delivery of those sort of projects, but I'm called upon quite often to give my opinion about what's happening next as a futurist, be it practical or otherwise. What's coming down the track and what do we need to know about? In fact, recently I was at the World Built Environment Forum held by RICS here in London. There are 1,000 built environment professionals from across multiple segments of that industry talking about what was going on. I've spent a lot of time talking to commercial property companies about what the future of work might be, whether it is working at a desk in an office or working remotely, or how the gig economy might impact the nature of work, the fact that people may not be working 5 days a week anymore for the same company. They might do 3 days here and 2 days there. How does that impact the physical space of going to work? What's happening here in London is that WeWork, I'm not sure how prevalent WeWork is in parts of Australia, but they're a serviced office company. WeWork in London are London's largest private office tenant. They have more space that they've leased than any other organization except the government. And so they are now offering essentially, I think, data as a service. The fact that you can rent space at a WeWork, they know what is the optimum capacity for that floor, what is the optimum heating and cooling for that floor, security, lighting, all those sorts of things. So they're a mini example, or they're a mini city. If you've got 400 or 500 people in each of their buildings doing things, they're almost mini cities. And I encourage the more traditional commercial property companies, those that lease and sell property, as well as those that own the actual infrastructure, to look at what the WeWorks of the world are doing, because they are hoovering up so much data, they will be able to use predictive analytics to work out where they should put another office and how big it should be. And I think we can learn a lot from these mini cities that are the WeWorks of the world.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really interested in your thoughts about what the future workforce will look like, because I think that really feeds quite well into the smart city space, but isn't necessarily something that's on everyone's mind.
Yeah, I think what I'm seeing is the fact that WeWork have taken so many leases, they're being very speculative. They've basically used the advantage of a lot of downturn in the property industry some years ago, where long-term leases were very cheap. They've taken 10-year leases for many of their buildings. So the nature of work is, well, obviously startups like the WeWork concept because they need somewhere to live and work, and they can't take long leases on their buildings. But what I'm seeing is that even banks now, there's a great example, Barclays Bank here in the UK have set up a concept called Rise. They've got facilities in India, in America. I'm not sure if they've got one in Melbourne or Sydney yet. But they basically take a whole building and they say, why don't we invite fintech startups to come and work in these buildings? We're going to charge them a commercial rate to rent the desks. But we then get the first view of what these startups are doing, and we get first almost right of refusal. And I think that concept could extend further into traditional organizations. So I did a talk last year about the future of work, and people were saying, you know, we're seeing people that are well into their career in their 30s and 40s are saying, you know what, if I have a choice not to have to work for the same company 5 days a week, I would do that. And I might sell my time to someone else, maybe not a competitor, maybe a competitor. And so I'm not going to need that desk 5 days a week. I'm not going to need a place to go and sit and work, but I'm going to need the ability to work from home or work from a client site. And what I'm seeing is that this loosely used term millennials are getting more used to working in more dynamic environments. However, I think what we're seeing, people are telling me that these open work plan workplaces, everyone's going open plan now. There's nowhere to think. There's nowhere to sit and talk. It's all open plan. So I think we may see a backlash. And in fact, what I've predicted is that Gen Z, these are the ones after millennials. My daughter's just turned 12, so she's a Gen Z. I think they're going to want to go out and get their hands dirty and dig holes and not always spend time in front of a screen. So we may see that the millennials are forcing us to work one way, and then there's a backlash, and the generation after millennials are saying, you know, we want to have an office with the door. So I think we need to be flexible. I don't think we need to throw out all the existing office environments, but having flexibility to reconfigure the place of work physically, but also how we get work done. Collaboration is a whole other topic in terms of using things like Slack and Chatter and Yammer to communicate with people in your own organization, but also communicate with the community. I would like to see a smart city concept, not just around tech that is IoT or smart lighting, but why can't citizens collaborate on new ideas with the local government authority via a collaboration tool like Slack? That, I think, is the future as well, where smart ideas can come from anywhere and they're welcomed.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, well, I'm currently living the millennial dream. So I work 3 days, contract 3 days a week to a company, and then the other 2 days I do this podcast and then some other stuff. And I think you're 100% right about even the Gen Zs, but even I guess the millennials coming through as well. It's not about having one option of, okay, well, I only want to work from home. It's about that flexibility and that and true flexibility and as in even not just where you work, but what work you're doing. So, you know, some days, yeah, you might want to get on a shovel and dig a hole, metaphorically or, you know, literally. But then also in that same vein, you might want to sit and think for hours on end, and that might not occur in an open plan office. That might be an office with a door. So yeah, no, I really like that concept. And I think that particularly the traditional, you know, larger corporations and governments are going to have to start thinking like that in order to attract the talent they need to keep moving forward.
Yeah, and the problem is the people making decisions about attracting the talent aren't of the age and flexibility of the talent. And so we may talk a bit later about this notion of digital diversity. When you've got the top table doesn't have to be the 50-year-old pale, male and stale. They need to be a diverse range there, because millennials, if you self-identify as one, that's great. You want certain things that your older and younger generations don't. And the question is, are those needs being anticipated?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about digital diversity. While I was waiting for you to come online, I was listening to your or watching your video. So I was really interested in that concept about the digital, or bringing digital to the board, because have a token young person at the board meeting, and didn't work so well, because when it's only a token person, you know, that's not very useful. So yeah, can you expand on that digital diversity and what that means?
Yeah, so there's a lot of talk about diversity of boards, and it has generally centered around female and male ratios, and there are a number of programs around to get to, you know, 30% or 40% or whatever that number might be. If you've been following what's happened in Australia recently, for those listening outside of Oz, the AMP and the Commonwealth Bank have come under fire. In fact, today as we speak, the Commonwealth Bank has been faced with a $700 million fine, the largest fine in corporate history. Ironically, their share price went up, which means that they got away scot-free, that the fine could have been worse. But what happened there, and the reports that have come out are saying there is a real problem with boards of today. They're not representative of the population. They're not making great decisions. They're the same sorts of people. And 2 weeks ago, Alan Kohler, who is an Australian journalist, wrote a really interesting piece that resonated with me. He said, yes, we need quotas for women. We also need quotas for people that understand tech, and quotas for people that have international experience. And I think those three work well together. if you've got a board of the same sorts of people, they're ex-CEOs or ex-managing directors or ex-lawyers, they all think the same way. And time after time, I hear that the board doesn't understand these digital concepts. In all of my talks, I now throw up a slide I call the scary slide. I deliberately put terminology and jargon on that slide that some people will understand for that industry that's in front of me, and some will have no idea. And that scares me that, you know, you've got a room full of people that don't know what some of these things mean that will actually impact and disrupt their business within the next 18 months. So I'm not suggesting for a moment you need someone who is really, really young and hip and funky on the board. In fact, in recent weeks, it may be that this digital diverse person actually isn't on the board full time because, frankly, they get bored with some of the stuff that's discussed. But you need to have the diversity of thought. So when you're discussing the new cloud platform you're going to do, and it's a $5 million spend, and the IT manager has put a proposal to the board are going, sounds right. Whereas a digitally literate board member would go, well, is it hybrid or cloud? What's the security like? What are we running on? Where's the redundancy? They'd ask the sort of questions that they need to ask. And the other issue that Alan brought up that obviously appeals to me is you need someone with international experience. I left Australia 12 years ago. I read the Australian news every single day. That's why I know the CommBank and ANZ are in the firing line, because I know what's going on, but I also know what's going on in the rest of the world. And that brings a global perspective. So the perfectly formed board would not have people all the same. They'd have more than one person that has the digital perspective, so that one person isn't just the digital dude and gets picked on. And they'd also have people like me, like 100 people I could name in London right now, that have really strong international experience and can bring that to the table. So the notion of digital diversity means you have a well-formed board that can navigate and negotiate any issue that comes at them. My perfect client is a company that is 100 years old, that is into insurance and knows that they're going to be disrupted. They've called on me saying, Andrew, you need to help us. We know we're being disrupted. How do we stop it happening, or how do we embrace it and move with the times?
Yeah, definitely. Well, that kind of leads to this next question, which is, how do you think we can better integrate, not just across, you know, not just in a board, but across the different disciplines and government, academia and industries?
Yeah, I think about this a lot. And a lot of the audiences I speak to are people that want to disrupt. And the thing I would always say to them is you need to involve the regulator. Think of the Uber example. Uber decided to launch in 100 cities. They weren't going to go and have a sit-down adult conversation with all the regulators about the taxi industry in that city. They would just go and launch their product and scale and scale and scale until they were told to stop. And that's what they did. So the regulators were kind of blindsided. Wow, this company's come in. They've seen the high profits from the taxi industry. They've written an app that basically makes it simple for anyone to become a taxi driver. Wow, we've got to quickly scramble to regulate this. And so the notion of having a discussion with the regulators and having them in the room when you're trying to disrupt is important, and the dialogue needs to be there. Conversely, I was very fortunate. About 3 months ago, I was invited by the Welsh government to come and give a TEDx talk. They did an internal TEDx, and it was a room full of regulators. I thought, brilliant, I've now got the other side of the fence. I keep telling disruptors they need to talk to regulators. Now I've got a room full of regulators. What am I going to tell them? And I gave them some very simple messaging that basically says, you need to think like a disruptor. Here's a dumb idea. I said, why don't you spend a day, a week at a WeWork or a service office to see what these disruptors are trying to do and see how your existing regulation or formulation is not making life easier. And I kid you not, three people independently came up after and said, I'm going to do that. And I said, well, this will be, it'll feel uncomfortable. First of all, you'll probably dress differently, so they'll see you there day one. What's the guy or gal in the suit? What's that all about? Within a few days, you'll overhear conversation and language you've never heard before, and you'll lean forward and go, hi, I'm Andrew. I'm from the Welsh government. I'd like to hear your thoughts about that. And then the dialogue would happen. And this may sound simple, but it is a very low key, low impact way of getting the regulators across what the disruptors are doing. If we were to mandate this and say, you know, you've got to have all these board papers and everything else, I think it's the informal networks that will happen. And then using collaboration technology, I see a world where disruptors, regulators, and citizens are all teaming together to brainstorm online or in a collaborative sort of hangout to help solve a problem. So I think you need regulators thinking like disruptors, you need disruptors thinking like regulators, and you need citizens being able to provide advice as well. And I think that is the future. Is that happening? No. But if I go to enough TEDx talks and I do enough presentations to disruptors and regulators, hopefully they'll all start talking to each other.
Yeah, definitely. And if they listen to this podcast.
Of course, which we'll promote heavily, and hopefully they'll listen to and take some great nuggets from it.
Definitely. So let's talk about emerging trends. I like to talk about the ones that people aren't talking about, and I'm sure you've got some ideas about that.
Yeah. So two things in the UK happened this year that are what I call regulated disruption. The first is open banking that has kind of happened in Australia, where they've got the open payments initiative that maybe that makes payment a bit faster, which is welcome. But here in the UK and across Europe, the open banking or payment services directive number 2, to give it a boring European name, means that banks now have to provide APIs so you can actually access your own data. And it kind of launched with a bit of a whimper in February because 5 of the 9 banks weren't ready, surprise, surprise. But this means that the smart fintechs can now take hold of my data with my permission and start doing fabulous number crunching on that to help me save or help me plan for my retirement, things like that. So that is the first thing that's happening that's different. The second thing is this thing that was launched last week called GDPR, and it affects everyone around the world, whether you're in Australia or in Europe, because if you're trying to communicate or market with someone like me that's in the EU at the moment, the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, now comes into place. A lot of marketers have said this is horrible, we won't be able to spam people anymore. I see GDPR as a huge opportunity and something people are not talking about, because beyond the regulation, it now allows consumers to put a value on their own data. And I think the notion of personal data ownership is something that people aren't talking about. Let me give you an example. I think we're about 5 to 7 years away from the notion of a digital agent. So my digital agent, who until recently might have been a human being that would organize my meetings and travel and all those sort of things, is now AI powered and knows everything about me. And I say to my, I don't say to my AI assistant that my health insurance is due in November, because it knows. And it goes out, and rather than reading ads that I have to do or go to comparison websites, it goes out and attempts to do digital deals with all the companies that I might want to talk to. And one of these companies is offering a digital deal where if I give my Fitbit health information, they'll give me a 40% discount. My digital agent that's AI powered knows that this is within my tolerances, and before I know it, the insurance is renewed. That means that we're going to have to start writing ads for robots, because robots, AI-powered robots and assistants, are going to make our lives a lot easier because they know all about us. The fact that banks and soon that telcos and utilities will have APIs to move the data around, the fact that GDPR really allows consumers to understand the value of their data is really compelling. And the perfect storm happened to Facebook about 3 weeks before GDPR launched. They had this Cambridge Analytica scandal hit, and Mark Zuckerberg's done his apology tour around the world, which really isn't an apology tour. We could have a whole other podcasts on that. But it has made consumers realize Facebook did what with our data? In fact, I read recently in Australia that Oracle and Google are in a bit of a fight. And Oracle did some tests on Google's Android operating system. And I'm not sure whether you use an Android phone. If you do, every month, a gigabyte of data is sent back to Google that has nothing to do with what you're doing. It sends back things like what's the barometric pressure, so it can work out what level of the store you're in, were you getting out of the car or getting into the car, and all this data is being sent back because we click the accept button. So the thing that people aren't talking about is personal data ownership, and this comes into play with smart cities as well, because there is so much data out there about me. I think consumers are going to say, I'll have some of that, and by the way, Facebook, your terms and conditions might not suit me. And so I want to negotiate with you my own personal terms and conditions. Because I think within 5 to 7 years, my data won't be sitting on a Facebook server. It'll be sitting on my server. And if Facebook want an update, they'll have to come to me, and then there to be a value exchange. It might be money, it might be coins, it might be a discount. But I think we are on the cusp of consumers like me that are empowered starting off, and then the late majority in maybe 10 years, you know, literally waving flags saying, I want my data back.
Mm. Yeah. I'm really glad you spoke about that, because I've been wanting to talk to somebody about that as well, because I think you're totally right. It should be thought about a way to empower us, but also a bit of a wake-up call, because I think a lot of us are very loosey-goosey with our data, but then we're all upset when somebody does something that we think isn't right with it as well.
Well, it's because we don't have the power to change it. At the moment, I have to click Facebook's terms and conditions. The alternative is I don't use Facebook. And so it's a binary contract, and there's no in-between. I think this year, of all years, will wake up consumers to say, hey, we want some of that. You're getting value out of it. The saying goes, if the product is free, the product is me. And it's very true with all of these services. Think about the ones you do pay for. I pay for LinkedIn. I pay for Vimeo. I pay for a number of services that make my life easier. And I also get a better response. The ones I don't pay for, like Google and Facebook, I have no recourse and I have no way to negotiate any level of service from them because I get it for free.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool. I only just have one last question, which is how can people connect with you?
Well, I have spent most of my adult online career making sure that when people type Andrew Grill into Google, I'm the first thing they see. So that's a good start. There are actually 16 Andrew Grills in the world, but for whatever reason, I own the front page of Google. Sorry, guys. I'm on Twitter at Andrew Grill. I'm on LinkedIn, and I have a fairly well-read blog at londoncalling.co. That's londoncalling.co. Welcome people's feedbacks, comments, criticisms, and we'd love to hear from some of your listeners as well.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. It's been such a great convo. Thanks so much for agreeing to come on to the podcast. And I think, yeah, we've got so many more convos that we could have for sure. And I think it's really refreshing to, yeah, have that practical viewpoint as well, because I think a lot of people are talking tech, a lot of people are talking in the future, flying cars, that kind of thing. But what can people do right now to prepare themselves for the smart city space? So thanks so much for doing what you're doing. It's really interesting.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for finding me. We worked out how you found me, and it was through about six different serendipitous connections. So this social media thing works.
It does. It so works. Thanks so much, Andrew. And yeah, look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Zoe.
It's the Smart City Podcast. Whoa.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart City Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes can be found at thesmartcitypodcast.com. If you have any questions or comments for me or any of my guests, connect with me via email, zoe@thesmartcitypodcast.com, or via the socials. I'm on Twitter and Facebook at Smart City Pod. As always, I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
Smart City Podcast is what you're looking for.